Insider reports and, you know, flashpoints and, you know, when it comes to prophecy, if a major event occurs, it's going to be a major event that will occur and it will affect people. You know, and it's not that a bunch of people will secretly get in a room and talk about how things are being fulfilled while the world sort of goes on as usual. You know, that's what, frankly, what was happening in, you know, years ago. We had our kind of our own in-speak, and to us, you know, I don't know what you could say, all kinds of things were happening, and yet at the same time we were warned not to tell other people. Well, I mean, if all these things really are happening, you should tell other people, you know. But anyway, what I tell people is that when major events happen, you're not going to need some special inside report, you know, whatever you want to call it, prophecy insider or something, that you that you either send ties to support or spend a lot of money to get a hold of or go through any effort to get a hold of. You'll know, it'll impact you. You know, when the Depression hit, people didn't have to go anywhere to find out they were in a depression. When World War II hit, we didn't have to get some, you know, prophecy inside newsletter to tell us we were in World War II, you know, that sort of thing. And likewise, when major events happen, they're going to happen. And there isn't going to be any doubt about the fact that they're happening. We're not going to have to convince anybody about that sort of thing. And so I've been telling people to be careful and not to overreact. Well, by the same token, when something does happen, I wanted to acknowledge it. Back when I was at USC, now usually I keep a low profile. I am cool. In fact, when I was in Jerusalem in 1970, I attended classes in the summer, Hebrew University-sponsored classes, and I always wore a little cap like many Israelis wear. Not a yarmulke, no. It's a kind of a, well, the best thing to compare it with is it's kind of like a dunce cap. That's what we called them. It's called a kovah tembel. It's a kind of it's a kind of a hat maybe a little child would wear if he's on an outing, kind of a cap, but it's a kind of a cap that a little child would wear on an outing. But anyway, the Israelis picture themselves, their country, as a little boy wearing that kind of a cap, whereas we picture ourselves in America as Uncle Sam, this great powerful man with a beard and a tall hat. The Israelis picture themselves as a little boy with one of these caps that they wear. Kind of, you know, almost like a sailor cap, but kind of turned up. Well, anyway, I wore this cap all the time, but even so, this is what a lot of Israelis wear, even if they're secular. So the point is that there was a very good friend of mine in class, a guy from UCLA, I think he was, you know, a professor of some sort or whatever, and he was taking classes that summer also with me, and he thought I was extremely liberal, practically an atheist. You know, so that shows you that I obviously wasn't wearing my religion on my sleeve. You know, I wasn't asking him every day, "Do you know the Lord?" or something like that, because he practically thought I was an atheist. So what I'm trying to say is, I tend to be cool about these things, but then every once in a while I decided, well, let's just have at it. Especially when I finished college, this was the last thing I was going to do before going to Big Sandy. It was my last hurrah, as it were, and I was taking a course in comparative political ideologies, I think was the name of the course, and it was this Korean fellow teaching it. It was at NYU in New York City. The campus then was in the Bronx. Later on, the entire campus moved down to Greenwich Village, but in those days there was still an NYU campus up in the Bronx near Yankee Stadium. Anyway, so I was at this, for my final exam, I decided I'm leaving anyway. I don't think the guy will fail me, so I'm just going to really have at it. So I wrote this essay almost like a sermon you'd hear at the, you know, in the old days at the Festival of Tabernacles, about the direction the world is going, how the human we really don't have answers. It's going to take divine intervention. I just really, you know, let it go, because I was leaving, you know. I figured the guy's probably won't fail me. He's a decent sort of guy. I think I got an A in the course, you know. So evidently, I try to be careful how I put it. I put it in words that an intellectual would respect. I quoted, for example, Bertrand Russell, who in those days, intellectuals loved Bertrand Russell. He was the famous philosopher who said, "Better read than dead." You know, if you remember, you know, Peacenik. But anyway, so he was beloved, and I quoted him. But anyway, but see, the fellow was a Korean. I thought back on that episode, and I said, how did that guy give me an A? How is it possible that I could be so confrontational and give me an A? And then I was thinking, well, a lot of Koreans have been exposed to religion very, very intensely. And even if he may not have been religious himself, he may have come from that kind of background. Maybe that's why he went ahead and gave me the, the good grade. Maybe if, you know, may have been a cultural thing. But anyway, I got by with it. Well, I did it again as I was leaving USC, but this time I wasn't as wild about it. But when I left USC, in my ethics class, I gave them all a paper, and I said, someday you'll appreciate this paper. And what I told them was, I said, fundamentalism is on the rise. I said, and indeed, that's even true in Judaism. I said, Orthodox Judaism is making a comeback. And I said that eventually the Temple Mount is going to become a very hot point. Jews are going to start agitating for the opportunity to pray on that mount, which, of course, Muslims do not want them to do. And I said, this could become a major concern, and it's something to be aware of. And I distributed that little paper, one of my last things I did at USC. Well, of course, the years have gone by, and it's basically fringers and kooks who have wanted to go on the Temple Mount, not reasonable people. As I said, the years have gone by, however, recently something came up that I felt like I wanted to bring to your attention. And this, again, goes back to my youth. Before I even was in NYU, I was in YU, which is Yeshiva University, which is an Orthodox Jewish university in New York City. And when I was there, there was a relatively young man. I say that because he's still alive, so he must have been fairly young then. A relatively young man who was the son-in-law of the greatest rabbi of that period, Moshe Feinstein, who was the greatest rabbi of that period. He died, I think, in the 1990s. Moshe Feinstein's son-in-law. And he was as Yeshiva University was a place where people were brilliant scholars and also brilliant Talmudists. It was unbelievable. These guys must have had IQs somewhere in the stratosphere. You know, they knew the Talmud back and forth, and they were also, you know, whatever they were, nuclear physicists or whatever they were. It was incredible. Well, there was this one fellow who was a biologist, and he also was a great Talmudist. And I had these pills I was taking for an allergy I had, and I asked him some picky little questions. I remember going up to him in the cafeteria at YU and saying, you know, Rabbi Tendler, these pills I'm taking, is it okay for me to take them during the days of unleavened bread? He said, yes, and that was the end of that. Later on, he became very famous as a bioethicist, and his name would come up because he was an Orthodox Jewish bioethicist. Certain issues would come up, and he'd be cited and quoted and so on. Well, now I find out that this man, who was a brilliant scholar and the son-in-law of the greatest rabbi of his period, and a modern, you know, cool, chic sort of guy who's quoted on the radio and all that, who was at YU, I find out that now he's going on the Temple Mount and praying. And it's become a major controversy. And I'm thinking, Moshe Tendler on the Temple Mount praying? You know, so when people like that begin to agitate to get on the Temple Mount, it is something interesting to me. You know, that modern Orthodox Jews are beginning to push for that. Because whether they know it or not, if they can only push so far, there's going to be a reaction on the other side. You know, Muslims are not going to want that. For Jews to actually pray on the Temple Mount formally, there's going to be a Muslim reaction. So it's something to at least be aware of. It's the first time I've seen reasonable people, rational people, actually praying on the Temple Mount. I was rather astounded to see that. But I didn't see that in some, you know, secret newsletter or something. I saw that in Jerusalem Post or the Jewish Press, you know, a major newspaper that anybody can read. So at least that's just a comment I wanted to make. As I said, I'm trying to warn people, because whenever there's exciting news, there are some people who try to make hay over it, frankly, in some cases, for their own benefit. Remember that Galveston, for example, which has been hit hard just recently, was hit harder in the beginning of the century. I think 6,000 people died that time. I don't know if even 6 people died this time. We'll find out. I hope not, but so far I haven't heard of any deaths in Galveston. But there were 6,000 a century ago. So, although it's a very serious tragedy, we want to keep our perspective and not get hysterical about these matters. Well, anyway, to get back to the main thrust of what I wanted to talk about, I wanted to discuss today conversations with God. People who actually had a conversation with God, and they were recorded. And there's there's some interesting lessons we can learn just from getting into it. You know, what did they say? What did God say to them? How did the conversation go? It's interesting to get into a thing like that. And there are some recorded times in the Bible when God intervened in a powerful way, a dramatic way, an unusual way, in the sense that people actually conversed with him in a direct sense, the way I'm talking to you now. That is not common in history, but occasions have happened, and the Bible records occasions. And I wanted to get into that today, conversations with God. And first of all, in getting into this, of course, some of what happens is that we're putting our spin on these when we read them. We want to be careful that we know we have enough biblical background to interpret what we're reading appropriately. In 1 Corinthians, the second chapter, Paul says that you can't really know what's going on inside of somebody else's mind, and nor can somebody else know what's going on in your mind. And certainly we wouldn't know what's going on in God's mind. In 1 Corinthians 2, verse 11, Paul says, "For what man knows the things of a man except the spirit of the man which is in him?" You know, only the spirit in you really knows what's going on mentally there. "Even so, no one knows the things of God except the spirit of God." So only God knows what he's thinking about and his plans. However, you know, God has revealed to us through His Spirit some of what He intends for us, enough so that we can understand, you know, what the purpose in life is. You know, as it says, "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the Spirit which is from God, that we might know the things that have been freely given to us by God." If we are Christians and if we've made that commitment, then we have received God's Spirit, and we do have a certain sense of what God intends, more so than others have. That's part of being a Christian. Now, I'm not sure where that line is to be drawn, but there are some things that Christians understand that others don't. You know, there are many things that everybody does understand. There are some things that not everybody does understand. You know, if they did, there'd be a billion members of God's church rather than just a handful. You know, so obviously there are some things that are, as the Bible says here, spiritually discerned. If you keep reading, I'll read in verse 14 since I brought up the phrase. Verse 14, "But the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him." So if you were to totally describe your way of life to somebody else, at least some aspect of it might come across as, "Well, why? That doesn't seem right to me." Well, you know, you need God's Spirit to really understand it. "But the natural man does not receive the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, nor can he know them, because they are spiritually discerned." So there are some things that are spiritually discerned. And that's why if a member of the Church of God got into a debate with somebody else, at some point, you know, they could only go so far, you know, and then you'd have to realize there's some things that are really not a matter of 1, 2, 3, 4, and you prove it. There's some things that are a spiritual issue, you know, and we're not trying to necessarily convince people in that way by a clever debate. I mean, there may be times certain issues ought to be discussed, like Paul, when in the first century, showed people, "Look, here are these prophecies. Christ fulfilled these prophecies," and so on. You know, to a degree, Paul did that. But there's only so far that can go, without God's intervention and His opening of people's minds. So what I'm trying to say is that when I go through this material, I'm trying to discuss what people might have been thinking, what God might have been thinking, and obviously, I'm limited in my ability to do that, but this material is here for us to do that. I mean, if it's here, it means that we're supposed to be getting some of that as we read. So the first conversation I want to talk about, I want to go back to Genesis 17. And here God appears to Abraham and begins to talk to Abraham. So it's not just a matter that he's getting, you know, some feelings, or he's studying or whatever. He's actually, God is communicating directly with him. It's something out of the ordinary. And he's telling him to be circumcised, and, you know, there's certain things. He's preparing to make a covenant with him and to give him a sign, you know, which is circumcision on the eighth day. But then as he continues to pray, now Abraham is 99 years old at this time, or at the very least in his 99th year. And now I'm into verse 15. God has changed his name to Abraham. He says that, you know, he's going to be the father of many nations. And then he even changes Sarah's name. Her name was Sarai, and now he changes it to Sarah, which is princess. Then God said to Abraham, this is verse 15, "As for Sarai, your wife, you shall not call her name Sarai, but Sarah shall be her name, princess. And I will bless her, and also give you a son by her. Then I will bless her, and she shall be a mother of nations. Kings of people shall be from her." Well, now, you know, Abraham had enough of a relationship with God to react to this. And his reaction was, isn't this a bizarre way of doing things? This is wild. Here I am in my 99th year. My wife's about a decade younger. And you want us to have a child now? You know, and he literally laughed about it. I think it's kind of interesting when God tells him this, and his reaction is, "Are you sure you want to do it this way? It just seems so out of the ordinary, you know." And he actually reacts to it that way. You know, then Abraham fell on his face and laughed and said in his heart, "Well, of course, here he's thinking this rather than saying it out loud. Shall a child be born to a man who is 100 years old? And shall Sarah, who is 90 years old, bear a child?" So this is what he was thinking. What he said was interesting. Here is what he said in verse 18. And Abraham said to God, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." He did already have a son. Now, the son had come through Hagar, but it was his son. It wasn't Sarah's, but it was his son. And by this time, Ishmael was 13. And he said, "Why don't you do these things through Ishmael? He's already here." Then God said, "No." So Abraham gave him an option, and God didn't take the option. He said, "All right, I understand your thinking. This is, in your mind, bizarre, weird, but that's my point. I'm doing this miraculously. I'm deliberately, miraculously giving you a child. So that child will be stamped as divinely given, miraculously given. That child is a type of Jesus Christ. That child is the child of the covenant. You know, this is all implied in what happens. But he's called Isaac, meaning laughter, because it is something that people laughed about when they heard it. Abraham laughed in his heart when he heard it. Sarah, when she heard about it, she also, you know, laughed in her heart, you know, but it happened. And don't forget that Christ himself was also born miraculously. It was a virgin birth. And I know that many Christians believe in it, but when Jews come together, you know, behind closed doors, they laugh about that concept. That's to them a laughable thing. And secular people probably the same. You know, just general liberal people, when they get together, the concept of a virgin birth is something that probably there's a lot of, you know, jokes about. But yet it is a miracle and part of the biblical account, and does stamp Jesus Christ as special. Verse 19, then God said, "No, Sarah, your wife, shall bear you a son, and you shall call his name Isaac. I will establish..." So, yes, it's something to laugh about in the sense of joy. Be joyful about it, because this son is going to carry on a covenant. A Messiah will come from this son. "I will establish my covenant with him for an everlasting covenant and with his descendants after him." But it's interesting. Even though that's true, God said he would still honor Ishmael. And perhaps part of the reason was because of Abraham's prayer. You know, when God first talked to Hagar about Ishmael, let's go back one chapter. You know, the first time that God directly appears to people after the Garden of Eden, in the Bible anyway, is as the angel of the Lord appearing to Hagar. God appears to Hagar, this Egyptian servant, this woman. I say this because, you know, you think of what would be lower than a Gentile woman servant, and yet that she's the first one to get a theophany. And so the angel of the Eternal appears to her, and he talks about Ishmael, and here's what he says. This is verse 12 of Exodus of Genesis 16. He says, she shall be a wild man. His hand shall be against every man, and every man's hand against him. And he shall dwell in the presence of all his brethren. So here's a person who will be evidently, you know, numerous, scattered. He'll be living, probably saying he'll live in the presence of all his brethren, meaning that he will, you know, he will not be just in a little corner somewhere, but he will have an expanse. He will have a lot of progeny. And it talks about him as being perhaps very manly and very virile and all that, but it's not necessarily indicative of national greatness here. The first comment made about Ishmael, you wouldn't necessarily know from here that he would become a great nation in that sense. You know, it talks more here about his warlike nature. But then, if you go to 17, he does say that I'm going to make Ishmael a great nation. If you go to 17:20, remember Abraham says, "Oh, that Ishmael might live before you." And so in verse 20, God says, "And as for Ishmael, I have heard you." Now this is a play on words. That's what Ishmael means. You know, Yishmael, God hears. And so he goes ahead and he makes a pun on it. And he says, "As for Ishmael, I have heard you. Behold, I have blessed him and will make him fruitful and will multiply him exceedingly. He shall beget 12 princes, and I will make him a great nation. So Ishmael was the ancestor of the Arab peoples who have had a major impact on world civilization. You know that when our numbers today that we use, we call Arabic numerals. It was in the Arab world that mathematics were preserved for so that the Europeans could then take that system, you know, take the ball and run with it, as it were. But a lot of civilization and culture was preserved in the Arabic-speaking world. Europe was going through the Dark Ages. And in the Arabic-speaking world, for example, the word algebra comes from Arabic. So the Arabs had a great civilization. They've had been a major people in the world, still are. They're certainly a major people today. But then he goes on to say in verse 21, "But my covenant I will establish with Isaac, whom Sarah shall bear to you at this set time next year." So it's an interesting conversation. You know, God says, "I'm going to give you a son through Sarah." Abraham thinks this is really wild. And then he finally says, "Well, I already have a son, Ishmael." And God says, "Well, yes, I know you have Ishmael, and he'll be great. You're concerned about him, and I'm going to make him great. But I have a plan, and supernaturally I'm going to give you a son, Isaac, and through him will be the covenant." And unfortunately, you know, to this very day, we have the religion of Islam, in effect, is the effort of Ishmael to, in effect, take the rule of Isaac. That's, in effect, what's happening. If you study Islam, you know, it's in effect, what's happening there is descendants of Ishmael, in effect, attempting to take the role that Isaac was to have. You know, and of course, that can't be resolved humanly. The only way that's going to be resolved, of course, is through divine intervention. There's another interesting conversation that Abraham had with God. Again, it's Abraham with God. You know, Abraham is called a friend of God, and we do find him interacting with God in very powerful ways. He's, of course, the patriarch of Jews, Muslims, and Christians, so he's an important, you know, figure in the Bible. And here in Genesis 18, again, God visits him in a way where he can talk to God, you know, man to man, as it were, in that kind of a way. And here we are in Genesis 18, or here I am, and I hope you'll join me. I'm in Genesis 18 and verse 17. Well, let's go to verse 16, because when God came, he came with two angels, and he sent them to Sodom and Gomorrah. I'm in Genesis 18:16. "Then the men rose from there and looked towards Sodom, and Abraham went with them to send them on the way." And this is something that is also part of hospitality. You not only welcome the guests, but you kind of escort them as they leave. That's part of the traditional hospitality, you know, escorting people as they leave. And I used to notice that when I dealt with Japanese people. Sometimes it would get me nervous. When we visited with these Japanese people, they would kind of watch us and walk out the door with us, and we would get in the car, and they'd still be standing there. And, you know, they'd be, finally, when we pulled out, they'd be waving to us as we were leaving, you know. And they didn't really leave until we were pretty much gone. That's the custom here. And, in fact, the Jews still have that custom regarding the Sabbath. On Saturday night, we ultras would get together and have a meeting Saturday night where we'd have music and instruction and whatever. And it was kind of a way of saying goodbye to the Sabbath and, you know, in a more formal way, you know, kind of... Walking her, escorting her out, as it were. We used to call it escorting the queen, the Malaba Malka, you know, escorting the queen out, you know, the Saturday night activity. Anyway, so he's escorting the angels out, and then he's back with God, who's still there. "And the Eternal said, shall I hide from Abraham what I'm doing? Since Abraham shall surely become a great and mighty nation, and all the nations of the earth shall be blessed in him." And so you see that God has a relationship with his people that he will let us know what's going on. And so if you have a relationship with God, you should have an understanding of prophecy that maybe others won't have. That should be the case. In fact, if you go back, I want to jump ahead, if you don't mind, to John 17. To John 17. And I think this is one reason why when the Church of God is spiritually sound, you know, spiritually awake and alive, there are some things that the church will understand that maybe others don't. I'm sorry, I want to go to John 16. I'm going one chapter back. I am now in chapter 15. So if you're taking notes, I realize it's upsetting, but it's chapter 15. Christ says in chapter 15, greater love in verses 13, and you know this verse, a lot of you by heart, John 15:13. Greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for his friends. But when Christ laid down his life for us, there were certain ones of us that had become literally his friends. Abraham was his friend, and these apostles had become his friends literally in a very special way. So he wasn't just laying down his life for mankind in the general sense. You know, there were certain ones he had come to know very deeply. You are my friends if you do whatever I command you. So now we become his friends too, if we do what he says. No longer do I call you servants, for a servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all things I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. So, you know, a servant doesn't know really what's going on, unless he maybe overhears or something, but the master doesn't necessarily let him in on it. But God has let us in on what he's going to do. And as I said, so if we are legitimately part of God's church, we should have a certain sense of what's happening. Maybe more, probably we should, more so than others, know what's going to be happening. That is valid. That's a valid point. Well, anyway, I want to go back to Genesis 18 now, if you don't mind. I'll go back there. And here again, we have God appearing to a human being in such a way that they can have a conversation. So he says, and he's speaking here in a human way. Theologians call this condescension in theology. It's where God kind of puts himself on the human level. I'm in verse 19. For I have known him, in order that he may command his children and his household after him, that they keep the way of the Eternal to do righteousness and justice, that the Eternal may bring to Abraham what he has spoken to him. And the Eternal said, because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave, I will go down now and see whether they have done altogether according to the outcry against it that has come to me, and if not, I will know. Well, obviously, he already did know, but this gives them a chance to not argue, well, if you had just come here and seen it for yourself, you know. No, he did. Or he sent these angels there. And you saw what happened to them in the next chapter, you know, so it was as bad as everybody was saying. Verse 22, then the men turned away from there and went toward Sodom, but Abraham stood still before the Eternal. Evidently, the original text says, but the Eternal still stood before Abraham. And Abraham came near and said, would you also destroy the righteous with the wicked? Suppose there were 50 righteous within the city. Would you also destroy the place and not spare it for the 50 righteous that were in it? Now, he's being very bold here, but he feels that God has taught him enough about how he behaves, you know, what is appropriate, and so he can bring this up. You know, would you do this? Far be it from you to do such a thing as this, to slay the righteous with the wicked, so that the righteous should be as the wicked. Far be it from you. Shall not the judge of all the world do right? And as I said, he's being very bold to bring this up, but he's arguing from the point of view of God's own way of doing things. So he's arguing from, you know, from what he understands as God's nature. So the Eternal said, if I find in Sodom 50 righteous within the city, then I will spare all the place for their sakes. And now Abraham begins to negotiate with God. And in the Middle East, people haggle. Haggling is a part of the culture. You don't just buy something. You argue about the price. There's a famous story about a British fellow who went underground to go to Mecca. Now, Mecca is only for Muslims. Non-Muslims don't go to Mecca. You can't get in. But he went underground and dressed up as a Muslim and went to Mecca. And supposedly, the story goes, he went to a food stand and he ordered a glass of juice. And the guy totaled the price and he went ahead and paid the price and didn't haggle. That was it. He was exposed. As far as I know, he lost his life. He should, because he was where he shouldn't have been. But how they knew he was not one of them is that he didn't haggle. You know, so anyway, it's a part of the culture there. But notice how he does it. He's extremely respectful. And that's the balance in these conversations. That's the balance. You know, God wants you to be able to converse with him, to ask him questions, to perhaps even question things. But at the same time, we have to understand our limitations. We have to be reverent, we have to be respectful, and we have to understand our limitations. Quite frankly, today, one of the things I was made aware of as just watching events here unfold is just how how minor human beings are. With all of our greatness, all of the talent that people have, all the things that people can do, we can now clone, we can, you know, make computers and do this and do that, send out rockets to the moon. But yet, you know, what power did we have about this over this hurricane? You know, incredible the power of this storm. And we're just fortunate it didn't do more, but it could easily have done more. We are so vulnerable to the forces of nature, just utterly helpless when if nature's full force comes against us, there's just nothing we can do. You know, so we are really very, very, you know, minuscule when you really think about it. And I remember when I was a child, there was a Jewish astronomer in Bridgeport, Connecticut. His last name was Stern, and he had a column in the newspaper. And wherever he spoke, he would always quote Psalm 8. You know, when I look at the heavens, because he was an astronomer, he said, when I look at the heavens and I see the stars, I think, what is man that you are mindful of him? He would quote from Psalm 8. You know, I one time went to him and I said, you seems like you're always quoting Psalm 8. He said, that's my signature. You know, that's how he always ended his talks. Well, anyway, we're here. And so Abraham says in verse 27, then Abraham answered and said, indeed now, I who am but dust and ashes have taken it upon myself to speak to the Lord. You know, so he's very careful, but yet he's still going to argue. Suppose there were five less than the 50 righteous. Would you destroy it, all of the city for lack of five? So he said, if I find 45, I will not destroy it. See, God is allowing him to go through this so that he will finally come to the point of thinking, wow, there aren't even 10 righteous people in that town? What kind of town is that? So get the 10, get the 8 out of there, whatever it is, and get rid of the town. You know, that's kind of, you know, that's what we're kind of getting to. You know, anyway, we're down to 29, verse 29. And he spoke to him yet again and said, suppose there should be 40 found there. So he said, I will not do it for the sake of 40. Then he said, let not the Lord be angry, and I will speak. Suppose 30 should be found there. So he said, I will not do it if I find 30 there. And he said, indeed, now I have taken it upon myself to speak to the Eternal. Suppose 20 should be found there. So he said, I will not destroy it for the sake of 20. And now finally we get down to the rock bottom here. Then he said, let not the Eternal be angry, and I will speak but once more. Suppose 10 should be found there. And he said, I will not destroy it, you know, for the sake of 10. So the Eternal went his way as soon as he had finished speaking with Abraham, and Abraham returned to his place. Well, obviously he couldn't find 10. And so he did choose to destroy those cities as an example. And then you can read about that further. So these are interesting conversations, and they do bring out, you know, the way God's people interacted with him. You know, their questioning was permitted in a respectful way, you know, within a certain, ground rules, you know, but it's not a zombie-like, you know, attitude. You're not like a robot. You know, you have an interaction there. I'd like to now go to a conversation that Moses had. Well, actually, first I want to go to a conversation Jacob had with God. This is a really interesting account. Here God actually wrestles with somebody. It's an amazing account. It's very revolutionary. God appears in the form of a man and literally wrestles with somebody. And so here we have Jacob wrestling with God. And it's just an amazing story. I find these things so interesting. Even all these years later, I've been hearing this account since I was a child, but just to think about it, it's still amazing to me. Of course, when I was a child, I didn't really understand it the way I did later. In Genesis 32, verse 24, then Jacob was left alone, and it is at this point, really, that he becomes converted. He goes from Jacob to Israel. The word Jacob means a supplanter, one who grabs the heel. So you could say his name meant heel. And that's pretty much what he was. He was a heel at first. Then he became Yisrael, a prince with God, or one who overcomes with God. You know, he's converted. So he starts off. So anyway, then Jacob was left alone, and a man wrestled with him until the breaking of day. Well, my translation capitalizes man, capital M-A-N, because it really wasn't just a man. It was a man in quotes. Now when he saw that he did not prevail against him, he touched the socket of his hip. So you see that Jacob really held on. And there's a parable in the New Testament about the importunate widow who kept bothering the judge, the unjust judge, and even though he was not a just man, but she just kept nagging him, so he finally went ahead and helped her. And Christ brought that out because to show us that we ought to pray persistently. We ought to persist and pray, and because God wants us not to just half-heartedly do it. He wants us to have a certain enthusiasm and zeal for what we do, and so we should be praying in a consistent way. And in this case, you know, Jacob kept holding on, wouldn't give up. So he finally touches him. He touched the socket of his hip, and the socket of Jacob's hip was out of joint as he wrestled with him. But he still hung on. So even though he gave him pain, he still hung on. And he said, "Let me go, for the day breaks." And so finally he asked Jacob to let him go. But he said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." So this is metaphorically an example of how to pray. You know, we keep on praying, you know, because we do want God to bless us. So we persist in it. We persist in it. We don't just do it half-heartedly, but we're persistent. So he said to him, "What is your name?" He said, "Jacob." And he said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel. For you have struggled with God and with men and have prevailed." So he did bless him in a special way. And Jacob asked, saying, "Tell me your name, I pray." Now, see, Christ was preparing to be Jewish, so he already began by practicing here, answering a question with a question. You know, "Tell me your name, I pray." And he said, "Why is it that you ask about my name?" Well, you know, because obviously you should know who you're wrestling with. You know, come on. You know, you ought to know what's going on here. In fact, you do know. You asked me to bless you, so you obviously know that I'm not just a person, a human being. "Why is it that you ask about my name?" And he blessed him there. Now, the name of God is a very powerful thing and an important thing, and God has certain, more than one name by which he's called in the Bible. And even in Genesis, the personal name of God can be found. For example, I hadn't planned to say much about this, but this issue comes up about God's name, and in these conversations it comes up. You know, when he said, "Who are you?" he said, "You don't have to ask who I am, you know." And he blessed him there. And so Jacob understood it was God, because if you keep reading, so Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, meaning the face of God. I have seen God face to face, and my life is preserved. That's where I want to leave the account. But I do want to turn back to Genesis 22 to show you how the name of God is in Genesis, in case some of you have forgotten that God's name is already in Genesis. Here's one place where you find it. And Abraham called the name of the place, this is Genesis 22:14, Yahweh Yireh, the Eternal will see, or the Eternal will provide. As it is said, "To this day in the mount of the Eternal it shall be provided." So, you know, here Abraham gave the name of the place, called the name Yahweh Yireh. So here Abraham is already using God's name. So it's not like they didn't know it. Now, some people think they didn't know it because of a phrase in Exodus, and maybe I'll comment on that later. I want to go to Exodus now, to Exodus 3. Now, here's another one of the great heroes of the Bible, and again, because he was a great hero in the Bible, a pivotal figure, God it appears to him in a special way, and he has a theophany. He actually has a conversation with God. This is in Exodus 3. I'm talking about Moses. Now, Moses in Exodus 3 was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. This is the area which is called Sinai also. It's called Horeb or Sinai. Since I'm on the subject of name, let's jump into that, because a lot of you now have a loose end. Some of you are questioning. So let's settle that. I want you to be at peace so you can pay attention to the rest of what I want to cover. And I see now that I'm not going to go, you know, cover everything I wanted to cover today. So let's go to Exodus 6. Then the Eternal said to Moses, this is at another time, and that now you shall see what I will do to Pharaoh, for with a strong hand he will let them go, and with a strong hand he will drive them out of his land. It's not that he's going to do it willingly, but I'm going to intervene in a powerful way. And God spoke to Moses and said, "I am Yahweh, I am the Eternal." The French Bible translates this as the Eternal, and the Moffat translation, and that's a good way to translate it, because remember, these names had a meaning when they were said. These weren't just sounds. You know, they had meanings. You know, and nowadays we just give people a name but the name has to be translated. We don't call people red or white or beautiful. Sometimes we do, faith, hope, sometimes we do. But most names have to be translated. But in those days, the name had an immediate meaning when you heard the name. It just like you hear the name faith, hope, grace. These have immediate meanings. So that name would have an immediate meaning. And one way to understand it is the eternal. I appeared to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob as God Almighty, El Shaddai. But by my name eternal, I was not known to them. Well, now wait a minute. We just saw that Abraham did use the name. So what does he mean by my name, the eternal, I was not known to them? Because he hadn't fulfilled the meaning of the name. That name is a name indicating God will fulfill his promises, will keep his covenant. That's the meaning of the name. And so he had not fulfilled his covenant to them. He'd merely made the promises. He hadn't kept them. Now he's going to fulfill them. So now he's going to fulfill the meaning of the name. See, I have also established my covenant with them to give them the land of Canaan, the land of their pilgrimage to which they were strangers. See, now he's going to fulfill the meaning of the name. So that's why he says he was not really known. He was not known to them by that name. Not that they didn't say it, but they had not experienced the implication of the name. Now their descendants would live it, the implication of the name. That's really the what's going on here. Anyway, let's go back now to Exodus 3. Moses was tending the flock of Jethro, his father-in-law, the priest of Midian, and he led the flock to the back of the desert and came to Horeb, the mountain of God. And the angel of the Eternal appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of a bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. This is a miraculous event, and it's a way of inspiring Moses, and it's a way of symbolizing God's relationship with Israel, that even though Israel, you know, may suffer, but it does not disappear. Then Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. So when the Eternal saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. Then he said, Do not draw near this place. Take your sandals off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. I am now appearing here, so this now sanctifies this area. So take off your shoes, which is something you own. You know, and now just be, you know, without any of your property, just your bare feet on that ground. Evidently, you know, having your bare feet on the ground indicates, you know, what you own is not touching the ground, just you are touching it, because it's my ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. That's one thing to understand, is when God appears to a person, it's a traumatic experience. And it's not something to necessarily seek. It's a very traumatic experience. And the Eternal said, I have surely seen the oppression of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters, for I know their sorrows. I'm going to skip ahead for lack of time to just say that you all know that God promised to deliver his people. But notice what Moses says in verse 11. But Moses said to God, Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So you see the kind of person God appears to? Not an arrogant, self-assured sort of person, but a person who understands his place. Moses knew what his abilities were. He'd been a general, and he'd been a pastor over sheep. He'd had at least some responsibility. You know, Jethro was the leading person in that nation where he lived. But still, you know, who is he to lead God's people out of Egypt? You know, he knew what his failings were. He knew what sin was there was in his life and what failings he had. And so he had a perspective here. Who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and that I should bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? So he said, I will certainly be with you, and this shall be a sign to you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. And then, quite frankly, it seems that Moses got to the point where he argued so much against going that God began to think, or let's put it another way, that he was in a way showing a lack of faith. He finally got to the point where his arguing was wrong, and God had to tell him, listen, I said you're going to do it. I know what I'm doing. You know, have the faith. I will be with you. You know, it got to the point where he, in effect, was trying God's patience in an anthropomorphic way. You know, he kept asking questions, there was a lot more I was going to cover today about God's name and so on, and this conversation, but I think I'll jump ahead, and let's go to chapter 4. Then Moses answered and said, "But suppose they will not believe me?" You know, he's still, you know, after all this, you know, "Suppose they will not believe me or listen to my voice. Suppose they say the Eternal has not appeared to you." You know, so God gave them these signs. But, you know, it's interesting. These signs are almost also a sign of God's displeasure. Because what is the sign? A rod becomes a serpent. That's not exactly an upbeat kind of sign. And the other sign is his hand becomes leprous. And then goes back to normal again. That's you know, sure, that's exciting, but that's not the most upbeat kind of sign. It's almost like God's telling him, "All right, you know, you don't seem to have enough confidence that I'm going to back you up. So here's some ways I'm going to back you up." But it's almost, in a sense, a way of telling, of chiding him. Come on, you know, let's get with it. Let's get with the program. And then after all this, let's go to verse 10. Then Moses said to the Eternal, "Oh, my Lord, I'm not eloquent, neither before nor since you have spoken to your servant, but I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." So now, you know, he says, I don't quite have the eloquence to do this, and I'm not a good speaker. And so the Eternal said to him, "Who has made man's mouth? Or who makes the mute, the deaf, the seeing, or the blind? Have not I, the Eternal?" You know, I'm all powerful. I created human beings. Some of them have defects, but I'm quite aware of all that. "Now therefore, go, and I will be with your mouth and teach you what you shall say." But he still argues. But he said, "Oh my Lord, please send by the hand of whomever else you may send." You know, so he does. It seems that it's gotten to the point where it's gone from humility to where he's trying to get out of it. And so finally, God says in verse 14, "So the anger." So God got angry over this. So Moses, in effect, had backed away too much. He was humble in the beginning, but then he got from the point of humility to trying to, you know, back out of the assignment, as it were, not to take on the assignment. "So the anger of the Eternal was kindled against Moses, and he said, 'Is not Aaron the Levite your brother? I know that he can speak well. And look, he's also coming out to meet you. When he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. Now you shall speak to him and put the words in his mouth, and I will be with your mouth and with his mouth, and I will teach you what he shall do, what you shall do. So he shall be your spokesman to the people, and he himself shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be to him as God. And you shall take this rod in your hand, and with which you shall do the signs." So there were no more excuses. So off he went, you know. And these things could have been worked out along the way, but Moses, I guess, had to have all of his bases covered, and to maybe more, to a greater extent than he should have here. A little bit of a lack of faith there. So it's interesting to think about this conversation with all the implications, and all I could do was just touch on it today. As usual, I have far more material than you'd have patience to listen to at this point. All right, I want to go to two more examples. The next example is Ezekiel. And the reason I giggled, you know, is because I'm going to this Ezekiel example kind of late in the game. But let's go to the Ezekiel example. Let's just summarize this example of what Ezekiel was asked to do. He was asked to cook something. Now, in those days, you know, manure was used as fuel. You burn a fire with manure. But God asked him to use human excrement, because this was going to be a very dramatic scene. This was to show people a punishment that was coming upon them, a very severe punishment. And to show how severe the punishment was, God asked him to use, as part of the fuel he was going to use, human excrement. And I'm going to go to verse 12 of Ezekiel 4. He tells Ezekiel, "And you shall eat it as barley cakes, and bake it using fuel of human waste in their sight." You know, this was a way of getting them to notice something, so that they would get the point. In those days, God often asked his prophets to do bizarre things to get a point across, and this was one of those times. But notice that God took into account Ezekiel's sensibilities. The reason I want to give this example is that Ezekiel didn't just robot-like, zombie-like do it. You know, he had some inhibitions about it, and he did ask. Respectfully, but he asked. You know, now in the case of Moses, he asked and he went too far. And when he went too far, God rebuked him for it. But it doesn't mean you can't ask questions. Then the Eternal said, "So shall the children of Israel eat their defiled bread among the Gentiles where I will drive them." So I said, "Ah, Lord Eternal, indeed I have never defiled myself from my youth till now." Ezekiel was a priest and was evidently very careful about his priestly responsibilities and had never been ritually defiled. And he didn't want to handle human excrement and use it as fuel. This was a bit much for him. "I have never eaten what died of itself or was torn by beasts, nor has abominable flesh ever come into my mouth." In other words, I've been biblically kosher. Put it that way. "Then he said to me, 'See, I am giving you cow dung instead of human waste, and you shall prepare your bread over it.'" So you see, God even modified his plan. He evidently had, you know, more than one option he could have used. One was very dramatic and very intense. The other would still get the point across, but it was less so. But he took into account Ezekiel's sensibilities. You know, evidently both ideas are going to work. The other would have been perhaps more dramatic. But he took Ezekiel's sensibilities into account. He said, "All right, use cow dung. That's a more acceptable fuel than human excrement. Okay, do that. And you shall prepare your bread over it." And then he went ahead and spoke more to Ezekiel. So I bring this conversation now to show that here a person, you know, had inhibitions, had qualms, expressed them, and then God actually said, "All right, if you feel that way, we'll do it this way." You know, so he could actually, in effect, change God's mind. You know, now, you know, there's even a greater example of that I skipped over because you're much more familiar with it, where God said to Moses, "If you step, you know, you step aside, and I'll just wipe this people out and start over with you." And he said, no, don't do that. And in effect, you know, he changed God's mind. So he didn't just say, you know, "Yes, sir, you want to wipe them out, you wipe them out." No. He questioned it. And he questioned it, and God said, and God agreed. When he questioned it, God agreed with him and said, "Okay, you know, we'll keep them alive and do it the way you want it done." So there are times to question in a right way, and God might even say, yeah, okay, I'll go along with your request. I'll do what you say. You know, it's interesting. At the same time, there's a time to be very careful and very respectful and realize that the answer is there and you shouldn't be pushing, which we also saw from Moses' case. There's a time to quit arguing and do it. You know, so it's a tension there, but that's part of the excitement of a relationship with God. You know, when is it right to question? When is it, you know, not right to question? You know, we have to have that sense. The final example then will be in Acts 10, and here again is where Peter questions something, rightfully so, and in this case he was right to question. In Acts 10, again I'll summarize it for the sake of being brief with it. Acts 10, Peter sees a vision, and in verse 12 of Acts 10, he sees a vision of all these animals, you know, lions and tigers and bears. Oh my! You know, he sees these animals, you know, all kinds of four-footed animals of the earth, wild beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. And by the way, when you get to the end of the Bible, they're still unclean animals. You know, if you go to Revelation, you can't go any farther. After Revelation, the Bible ends. In Revelation 18, verse 2. And by the way, if you go to the end of Isaiah, which really is very futuristic, Isaiah is projecting out way into the future. It talks about new heavens and new earth. And if you go to the end of Isaiah, you see unclean animals talked about there and condemnation of those who eat them. And here in Revelation 18:2, "And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, 'Babylon the great is fallen, and has become a dwelling place of demons, a prison for every foul spirit, and a cage for every unclean and hated bird.'" So you have unclean birds even at the end. You know, so if you're wondering whether you ought to eat vultures, no. Anyway, in Acts 10, they have their role to play, but not as food. You know, that's not their role. So anyway, here are these all these animals beasts, creeping things, and birds of the air. You know, what is there? There's this even show on, there's a show on TV now. What's it called? Unusual Foods or whatever. I forget, but somebody goes around and eats whatever. And that's entertaining. People watch that now. I don't condemn him. He doesn't. I suppose he doesn't know any better, whoever's doing it, you know. But that's the world that we live in now, where we watch people eat, you know, all these kind of critters. And anyway, verse 13. And a voice came to him, "Rise, Peter, kill and eat." And Peter said, "Not so, Lord, for I've never eaten anything common or unclean." Same language as Ezekiel. Well, he knew he'd read the book of Ezekiel, so he knew what Ezekiel said. You know, "I've never eaten anything, so I've been biblically kosher. I can't eat those animals." And a voice spoke to him again a second time, "What God has cleansed, you must not call common." This was done three times. Why? Well, for one thing, it reveals God's will, but also because three people were coming to him. Three Gentiles were coming to him. And you know the story. These three Gentiles were coming to him on behalf of Cornelius. Anyway, this was done three times, and the object was taken up into heaven again. Now notice in verse 17. "Now while Peter wondered within himself what this vision which he had seen meant, behold, the men who had been sent from Cornelius had made inquiry for Simon's house and stood before the gate." He was still wondering what it meant, because he knew it didn't mean literally go eat unclean food. That couldn't mean that. So what did it mean? He was thinking about it, wondering about it. And finally, he understood in verse 34. "Then Peter opened his mouth and said, 'In truth, I perceive that God shows no partiality, but in every nation, whoever fears him and works righteousness is accepted by him.'" So now he understood the vision. So he told God, "Obviously, you don't mean that I should eat this stuff." And God, in effect, said, "That's right. What do I mean?" And now he knew what God meant. And you know what's interesting is that in the 11th chapter, he repeats the story. So we'll get the point. You know, he repeats the story again. And he goes through the whole thing again. And in verse 9 of chapter 11, Peter repeats this vision, because God spoke to him in the vision. "But the voice answered me again from heaven, 'What God has cleansed, you must not call uncommon.'" I'm sorry, "You must not call common. Now this was done three times, and all were drawn up again into heaven. At that very moment, three men stood before the house where I was, having been sent to me from Caesarea." And then, finally, in verse 18, let's go back to verse 16. After these people began to show the fruits of being converted and having God's Spirit in verse 16, "Then I remembered the word of the Lord, how he said, 'John indeed baptized with water, but you shall be baptized with the Holy Spirit.' If therefore God gave them the same gift as he gave us, when we believed on the Lord Jesus Christ, who was I that I could withstand God?" And verse 18, "When they heard these things, they became silent, and they glorified God, saying, 'Then God has also granted to the Gentiles repentance to life.'" So here is a, you know, really interesting example of God speaking to somebody. The person questioned, "What do you mean?" And so in effect, he waited, and then he got the meaning, because something happened immediately that showed him what God meant. So he waited, and he got the answer. This is, just an interesting conversation with God that I wanted to bring to your attention. So rather than undermining, you know, an important principle of God's law, it reinforces it. Now, I would like to conclude by saying this. We want to be able to do this. We want to be able to converse with God, to interact with him. We are not, I'm not Moses, no, neither are you, probably. I can't say that for sure, you know, but neither probably are you. I'm not Peter, probably neither are you. I'm not Ezekiel. What are the other people I brought up? Abraham. I mean, we're not on that level. I'm sorry if it bothers you to say that, but we're not on that level. So we're not going to necessarily have this kind of experience. But that doesn't mean that we can't be conversing with God, speaking to him and listening to him, because prayer is not just for these people. Prayer is for everybody. At the same time, being taught by God is not just for these people. We have this material in front of us. We have God's inspired word that he has made available. And a lot of people have sacrificed a lot, not only to preserve the book, but also to translate it into languages that where people could read it and understand it. And so we can, through prayer and study, have this same kind of interaction and conversation with God. I'd like to turn just to two verses on that as a conclusion. I hope that what I've done today has stimulated you to perhaps go back over these accounts and maybe read other accounts of conversations with God, because we have accounts like that in the Bible, and they're very interesting in terms of how people react, how God reacts, and as I said, they're certainly a part of the Bible that is fascinating and should be talked about and studied, and that's why I chose to do that today. But I want you to remember the word ASK, A-S-K. The word ASK, A-S-K, because it's an acronym for what I'm going to tell you. This is in Matthew 7:7. A-S-K. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. This is what Christ says in Matthew 7:7. So just remember the word ASK. Ask, and it will be given to you. Seek, and you will find. Knock, and it will be opened to you. For everyone who asks receives, and he who seeks finds, and to him who knocks it will be opened. And one last verse is in Second Timothy, the second chapter. Because God just doesn't want us to talk to him, he wants us also to listen. What kind of conversation is it if you do all the talking and the other person doesn't say anything? That's not so good. Have you ever been on a conversation like that where you couldn't get a word in edgewise? You know, that's not so good. So you want to also listen to God. Well, how do you do that? You read the Bible. And if you read the Bible, God can direct the Bible. You're reading the Bible in such a way that what you need to see, you will see. And what you need to understand, you will understand. God has, you know, give God that much credit, you know, that he inspired the material. As you study it, it will impact you in ways that will be very helpful to you. And so in 2 Timothy 2 and verse 15, it says, "Be diligent to present yourself approved to God, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth." In other words, let's get into the Bible and be able to apply it in an appropriate way, apportion it out appropriately, you know, rightly dividing the word of truth. So I've talked about conversations with God today, and I hope that all of us will continue to have our own conversations with God. Well, I thank you very much if you've listened, or even I'm going to project forward that some of you may yet listen at another time in this world of marvelous electronic miracles that we have available to us through technology. At the same time, though, we realize our limitations, you know, realize that we all depend on God for every beat of our heart and every breath of air we breathe. Keep that perspective in mind. The moon is just about full. It's just 2 weeks to the holy day season. And I hope that you enjoy the rest of the Sabbath and that you have a wonderful holy day season. And also, please keep in mind those who are facing the challenges that many are facing now. Keep them in our thoughts and prayers. All the best to you and yours.